Hello, Ramona Koval here with The Book Show on ABC Radio National. Today, a conversation from the archives, one I recorded from my old program, Books and Writing, with Canadian writer, editor, radio producer and translator Paul Wilson, whose translations of modern Czech writers over some decades brought the work of people like Václav Havel and Joseph Skvoretsky to the attention of English language readers. And later in the program, we'll look at the latest novel in a trilogy from American author Wendela Vida, plus the final of our first-person reading of Jenny Diski's Skating to Antarctica. At first, I'd been under the impression that I was unfamiliar with the work of Paul Wilson. Then I went to my bookshelves at home and realised that I know his work very, very well. All the books I had by Czech writers, Ivan Klima, Václav Havel, Joseph Skvoretsky and Bohumil Hrabal, were translated by the very same Paul Wilson, whose name sat quietly on the title page of these books, and of course I'd failed to notice it, which I guess is the case always for a translator. And in his other work as editor, radio producer and co-writer, Paul Wilson is indeed a model of self-effacement in order to make the work of others shine. But as you'll hear, he's a very interesting essayist, critic and writer in his own right. Born in Ontario and educated at the University of Toronto and King's College, University of London, he spent 10 years in Czechoslovakia between 1967 and 1977, where he taught English and learned Czech. He was eventually expelled by the communist government for his association with the dissident movement, particularly for his involvement with the underground music scene as a member of the legendary rock band, the Plastic People of the Universe. So when we met in Montreal at the Blue Metropolis Literary Festival in 2004, I asked Paul Wilson how he came to be in Czechoslovakia in 1967 in the first place.
It sort of happened by accident. I was doing graduate work in London, which I never finished. And I was working on George Orwell, and so I was kind of interested in what was going on in Eastern Europe in a peripheral kind of way. And one day I met a couple of Czechs in a bar, and they were over on a holiday of some kind. We got into an argument about Orwell and communism and socialism, and they said, well, you've really got to come and sort of see it for yourself because you obviously don't know the first thing about it in real life.
What was your position in this argument?
Well, my position was that socialism was something that could probably work if it was given a try. And I'd also seen, at the same time, there was a festival of Czech films in London, and there were early films by Miloš Forman and a few others. And these films, I went to every single film, and I really enjoyed them, but I knew there was something I couldn't understand. It wasn't just the subtitles. There was some quality in these films that really intrigued me. They seemed to be sort of ironic, but I didn't know what they were being ironic about. There was a film called Joseph K., mm-hmm. It was about a guy who was trying to return a cat that he had rented from a cat rental place. And the whole film is about walking through Prague in this sort of, and I'd never been to Prague. It was just these dark, sort of mysterious streets, and he was trying to return this cat. And everywhere he went, he was turned away, saying, "Well, you didn't rent the cat from us. It must be somebody down the street." He went deeper and deeper into this labyrinth, and I can't remember how the film ended, but it was obviously a reference to Kafka. And all the films were sort of dark and mysterious. And so it was partly the argument with these people that inspired me, and partly these films, which inspired me to try to get behind what was happening. I thought I should know something more about that place.
In your book about, it's a collection of stories about Prague, isn't it? The preface to your work, Prague, A Traveller's Literary Companion.
Right.
You wrote of the turbulence of the history of the city and the ebb and flow of radiant optimism and dark despair, which you say, and this is I'm going to quote you if you don't mind.
Sure.
Which you said brings a black humour tempered with gentle irony, sentiment without sentimentality, a sense of romance without romanticism, a scepticism without cynicism. And any reader of Czech literature has surely to recognise these modes in much of literature that comes from that place and that has been translated by you too. But where did you get your affinity for these ways of being? Because that must have appealed to you.
I don't know where it came from. I think I was just... I grew up in southern Ontario, And it's a very flat country where people don't speak much.
So no radiant humor tempered no with gentle humor, irony.
No, not even in Alice Munro, who when I finally came back to Canada after long years abroad, I realized that she had actually sort of written about that territory where I grew up. It's not what you'd call, there's not sort of scintillating conversation and deep despair. It's still, you know, she represents it accurately. But when I grew up, people didn't talk much. I grew up in a dry county, so they drank at home. There was no sort of public life in the sense that there is in Europe. And what attracted me to Czechoslovakia, I think, was there was a kind of when I was living in London, I gravitated towards Irish bars, where there was a lot of conversation and a lot of humor and a lot of irony, and all the jokes were against the Catholic Church. And when I arrived in Prague, I realized that it was a similar kind of society where the focus is not the living room, it's the bar, where drink is the lubricant of human communication, and where all the jokes were political, not directed against the church, but directed against the party or against the society.
So how old are you then? When we were arriving at 67,
yeah, I was about 25, 24.
Okay,
25.
So you're 24, 25, yeah. And you've come to discover if socialism can work anywhere,
right?
And you get a job as a teacher.
That's right.
Teaching English.
Yeah.
Did you don't speak Czech?
Not
at
a
that
word.
Stage.
Well, one word. I knew the word for beer, and and you build on that.
I can imagine a few words that you might need after beer after that.
Yes.
At 25.
Yeah.
So you became radicalized, I suppose.
I thought I was radicalized when I went.
But really radicalized, which was sort of re-examining your own assumptions.
Yeah, it took a while. I mean, when I first arrived there, you have to remember it was 1967. And so this was about 10 years after Khrushchev had made his famous speech, and there was a great sort of wave of liberalization went through Eastern Europe. I shouldn't say a great wave. There were ripples. And by the time I arrived in Prague, it was already making headlines in the West as a place that was kind of opening up. So it felt to me as though the place were moving towards some kind of greater democracy. At the same time, everything was socialist in form. So my first impression was that, yes, it does work because, you know, there was no private property. The stores seemed to be full of stuff. The surface impression was that it worked. And it took several years, actually, before I began to really understand the depths of what was not working about the place. And even what I thought I was seeing in 1968, which was this attempt to make socialism work, was really not that. It was the last sort of hurrah of a dysfunctional system.
You wrote a piece about Dubček, actually, in the New York Review of Books.
That's right.
About a review of his memoir.
That's right.
And that struck me when I was reading that, I mean, Dubček is a sort of a classic Czech character out of literature, really. I don't know, the way you described it is he was sort of a little bit confused even to the end. He wasn't really sold on socialism as it was being presented to him to present, even though he talked the talk.
Yes.
There's a novel in there somewhere.
Well, the interesting thing about Dubček was, and he's the most famous figure from 1968, was that, and I realized this only after reading his biography, was that Dubček was a natural politician. He would have been a politician anywhere. He came from, you know, the boondocks.
No matter what
Slovakia.
The politics was.
Yeah, he was a person who knew everybody in town. He knew everybody in his constituency, if you like. He understood politics as a way of making people's lives better. And communism was the only game in town, so he played it. And that was why he was able to come to the fore in 68, because it was that kind of natural politician that people wanted to lead them, not someone who was an ideologue, but someone who actually, you know, understood how people thought and felt and lived. And the tragedy of his life is that it was, or the tragedy of that part of his life, because, I mean, he was eventually vindicated, was that it just didn't work. He didn't have the authority that the Russians needed to keep the lid on. Once he took the lid off, the genies escaped and it was out of his control.
So when did you start translating?
Pretty early on, right away. Translation is a really good way to learn a language, and it's a good way to teach it as well. So when I started teaching, I didn't know any Czech, but I would get my classes to help me. For example, I would get them to translate short pieces by Škvoretský or by Hrabal or by people like, well, not so much Hrabal because he's pretty difficult, but fairly straightforward, you know, little newspaper articles. And then I would get them to read their translations out, and I would critique the translations at the same time asking them where this particular word or this particular phrase came from, and I used that as a way of improving my own knowledge of Czech. I have to say, I taught in Brno. I taught four or five classes of 18-year-old girls, okay?
Lucky you.
Well, I don't know. It was pretty difficult because I made a rule to myself that, you know, I wouldn't get involved with any of them, but they didn't care about the rules, right? It was my rule, not theirs. And a delegation of them came to me one day, and they said, "Mr. Wilson, we want you to teach us some real English." I said, "What do you mean by real English?" And they said, "You know, the real English, the kind that people speak with all those words that are not in our textbooks." And I said, "Okay, fine, we'll do it. I'll do it, but you have to teach me the real Czech." So I would go out with them in the evenings, and we would sit around in these bars. And I had a notebook, and I would teach them the real English.
And would you like to give us an example?
Well, you know it all. Come on. It's just, you know, like spoken English with not just vulgarisms, but slang and stuff like that. I did this not just with my young classes, but also with my adult classes. And so I actually exploited my students to teach me Czech at the same time as I was teaching them English. Three or four years later, I was all living in Prague, and we were exchanging a flat with one of my students who had since married and had a family. And we moved into this empty flat, and I was cleaning the shelves in a cupboard, and I pulled down a paper hat, and there were all these vulgar English expressions that I taught them written all over the hat, like "fuck off" and "bugger off," and it was written all over this hat. And I wish I'd kept it because it was kind of like a legacy of my English lessons after hours. It's really funny.
Well, you mentioned Hrabal when you were saying that was a little bit hard for the class to translate.
Right.
And in the note at the end of the translation, I think, of "I Serve the King of England," you say Hrabal's work, Czechs say, is untranslatable. And the book was a response to that challenge. And there's even a word for Hrabal's special way of using Czech.
Hrabalovština, yes.
Now, that is quite something for someone who has not grown up in the languages to decide to choose that one. Because there seems to be a special responsibility on the translation of this book, as that it's a fantastic journey that requires the momentum of language in order to keep mm-hmm. it up, I would have
right.
thought. Is that right?
Well, the thing about Hrabal is that his Czech is all based on, you know, years and years and years of conversation and sitting around in bars and talking. And Czech is a language that is inflected, so you can play with the language in ways that you can't play with it in English. You can make words up by adding suffixes or prefixes. Words that don't exist are very easy to come by. And the meaning is clear because of how the word is structured. And the Czechs love to play with language. You know, you go into any bar, you overhear conversations between people, and it doesn't matter whether they're educated or not, there's this love of playing with language. And Hrabal draws on that, as does Škvoretský. And that's how I learned Czech. So I have a very close affinity with the way Hrabal writes. The problem is that when you translate it into English, which is a language that developed in far broader, more sort of historically different conditions, and there are many, many, many different English languages. So the real problem was to find a tone that was appropriate. And one of the solutions I came up with was to try to make it as vivid as possible, as sensual as possible, so that I really kind of cranked up the sensual aspect, meaning there was a visual image. I really tried to make it vivid in English so that what was lost in the play of words would be gained in the vividness of the writing. And it's a trade-off. I just read a critique of one of my translations of Škvoretský's, which was The Engineer of Human Souls, which a lot of young Czech critics think is one of the best books he ever wrote and one of the best books of modern Czech literature. And so there's this whole new generation of Czech critics, and they're very serious, and they're about 28 years old. And they write these very serious articles in very serious Czech journals. And they took me to task for not really coming to grips with Škvoretský's language in that book, which takes place partly in Canada and partly in Czechoslovakia. You know, it doesn't bother me that they said, "This is an untranslatable book. Wilson made a stab at it, but he didn't really succeed. He missed this and he missed that." But, I mean, that's the trade-off. It always happens, you know. You don't worry about it too much.
Well, I think your translation of I Serve the King of England is it's a wonderful book, and it's funny from the first page. You know, as soon as you read that first page where he's told not to listen to anything and then he's told to listen to everything.
That's
and,
right.
You know, you think, this is a Czech novel.
That's
I'm
right.
entering.
Yes, exactly. No, I think that the reason why that's one of his best books is because the central character is so compelling.
Mm.
And it would be very hard, excuse me, to translate something which was just a play with language. If there's character and action and setting and plot, then you can overcome the difficulties of language. If it were just a kind of a pastiche of language play, I'd find it really hard to do.
For Dvořák in Love...
Yes.
I keep saying Skvoretsky, but you say
Skvoretsky. You've got to roll that R. Okay.
But this is a very different book with a whole new set of musical notation research to do, do that translation. Is that what you have to do?
Yes. Fortunately, Skvoretsky is a writer who does a lot of research as well. And when I first read the book, I went to Joseph and I said, now, do you have any research that can help me? And he pulled out two big shopping bags full of stuff, which was really amazing stuff. He gets away from the Czech background of his childhood, which is where he draws a lot of his stuff from, and he writes about a character who is born in the last century. Well, it was the last century then, in the 19th century, but who comes and encounters America, and I think he uses some of his own experience in encountering America to kind of build that up. But he creates a whole picture of New York and America in the 1890s, which is really fascinating. And he did a tremendous amount of research. I mean, he read book after book after book describing the street life in New York, and he drew on that. One of the most difficult things was that there are characters in that, there are black musicians who I didn't know how they would have spoken. And fortunately, Joseph had found an autobiography by Will Marion Cook, who was the first, who was a student of Dvořák's, and who wrote the first black Broadway musical. He actually taught Gershwin as well, so there's a kind of a direct line right through there. And he wrote an autobiography, and his voice is right there. And some of the attitudes that Joseph attributed to these people in the black cultured class in the 1890s, I thought he was making up, but it's right there in the research. So I was able to kind of clone bits of conversation and bits of reported dialogue and then build it up into a voice as well.
What about working with the writers who are alive? Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Oh, it's a good thing. There's nothing worse than a dead writer looking over your shoulder. I mean, it's just they're very tyrannical.
Are they?
You feel much greater sense of reverence when the writers are dead. And Joseph is incredibly generous. The great thing about Joseph is that he is a translator himself. He's aware that the translators sometimes have to take liberties with the original. And he wasn't too upset when I did that with his.
Let's talk about the translation you've just done of The Beggar's Opera, Havel's play.
Yes.
It's a play that, well, you tell the story of the play because in the preamble there's a wonderful description of the night the play was put on.
Right.
The politics around that.
Right.
Can you talk about that?
The Beggar's Opera... was based on John Gay's version of the play, not Brecht's version, and Havel was very clear to point that out because, as you know, that became the Gay version, which was written in the 18th century and was and still is the most popular British play ever written. It was adapted by Bertolt Brecht as the Threepenny Opera, and Havel, who is not a great fan of Brecht, tried to make it clear that he was going back to the original. What's different about his play is that it's set in the 18th century, but the language is 20th century Central European language. So there's a funny kind of disjunction there. And the other thing about it is that there's no music. So it all depends on the sort of play of language. Now, this is a play about corruption, and it's a play in which the two main characters, one of them is the head of the London underworld and the other is the chief of police, and of course they turn out to be in cahoots. And the victims are the petty criminals who just can't fit into these big organizations. And so this was a play, obviously, that could not be performed. He wrote it in the 70s when his name was not even allowed to be used in public. Some friends of his got together, and they did an underground performance of this play. It ran for two nights. in a pub outside of Prague. And this was the first time that Hubbell had ever seen his plays performed after 1968, after the Russian invasion. So it was quite an exciting event. Of course, the police found out about it and arrested everybody in the cast and a lot of people in the audience as well, and went through the usual things. But it was a real triumph because he actually managed to pull it off. And so in the publication of the English translation, there are photographs from that performance, although it's been performed many times in Germany. And most recently, my translation was performed in London to mark the end of his 13 years as president. So it still has a life. But it's one of these plays that, I mean, it's so classic, and it's the way it deals with corruption. But it has a Havelian twist, because one of the things that Havel keeps saying is that truth is not, it does not reside in what is said, it resides in who says it, to whom it is said, and the context in which it is said. And in this play, the remarkable thing about it is that everyone tells the truth. Whenever someone is caught out in a lie, they resort to the truth as a way of covering up their lies. And so it's a very modern play.
I read your translation before I read the introduction, because I thought that would be wise. And I was wondering, you know, while I was reading it, I was thinking, why was this play so dangerous? And you were saying that, as a translator, that's a problem, to put context in.
All of Havel's plays played in Prague do have a very different resonance than they have when they're translated or performed outside. I've seen performances of his plays played in Czech in Toronto, and they don't have the bite that they do inside the country. It's not a question of the translation, then. It's a question of the audience and their lives. His plays were written out of a real situation in which people were surrounded by lies and manipulation. So he satirizes that in his plays, and the satire is much more biting if everyone in the audience kind of agrees about what's happening to them, right? I don't know whether that answers your question, but the challenge is, when you're translating, is to get that same kind of clarity in the way it's done, so that in the Beggar's Opera, I played up the metaphors of big business, which are there in the original, but you crank them up just a tiny bit so that you see that what we're talking about here is really large organizations run by overarching ideas that are behind these master criminal organizations, right?
So when you say cranking it up, can you just give me some example of what a kind of low-level word or phrase might be and what a cranked-up phrase might be?
Oh, you've caught me. I can't come up with a quick example, but the criminal, the master criminal Peachum, thinks of himself as a kind of like an organization man. I mean, he says that, this is the modern world. He tells these petty criminals, you can't go out just pickpocketing on your own. You have to belong to my organization and work for it, right? And so I used words that people can relate to when they're talking about how large corporations operate, words that might not have been a direct translation from the Czech, but which represent the idea in the Czech that would more immediately communicate with our audiences here.
So. Can we turn now to the book called 57 Hours?
Yes, we can.
Which was co-written by Veselin Netkov.
Right.
And Veselin Netkov was an eyewitness. He was taken hostage by Chechen terrorists in Moscow a couple of years ago,
right,
in the theater. I think you probably all remember that. So it's his story,
yes,
but it's the story as well.
That's right.
And tell me about your role.
It might seem odd, but it's very hard to take a situation like that and make it really dramatic, because part of the drama is in what you don't see. So if you can imagine, most of the time, if you're a hostage in a theater and you're being held there for 57 hours, it's a long time, it's almost 3 days. Not a lot happens. There are bursts of activity, but there's no structure to it. It's chaotic. And so in order to give it more structure, we actually, and this is the advice of my wife, Patricia, who saw the dramatic potential in the information about Chechnya, we brought a lot of background in so that the background plays against the foreground. It actually makes it much more dramatic and much more real if you know that these guys are, in fact, coming from a long tradition of gangster separatism. There's a sense in which I certainly felt a sympathy for the Chechens and the way they've been dealt with by the Russians. At the same time, a total lack of sympathy for the means they chose to make their case. So it became more than just a matter of ghostwriting someone else's story. It became a matter of writing a book using that person's story as the main line through.
And he agreed that the full story about what was going on outside the theatre, as well as what went on some hundreds of years ago in Chechnya, that this would add to his story.
Oh, absolutely, yes, yeah. Especially when he saw the results. I think he was a little worried at first that it would pull the reader's sympathy too much towards the Chechens. But I think that it's good to have that tension in your response to a book. In fact, these women with bombs strapped around them become figures of sympathy. It makes it much more difficult for you to kind of sort your own feelings out, and that's good. It's good to complicate the reader's life a little bit. You know,
and then, of course, like when the rescue attempt is made and the sort of the stuff up with Soviet-style bureaucracy about what the gas was that they were using and telling the people in hospitals who were trying to resuscitate people
right.
what they were using to anesthetize them, really.
Well, see, this is the whole thing. The most remarkable thing that I found when Veselin first told me his story was that he said that at a certain point he realized that the Russians were in the theater, the hostages were more afraid of being rescued by their own people than they were of the terrorists. And you might laugh, but I mean, that's absolutely true. There's a moment in the book which we realized when we went to Moscow and we talked to the woman who was with Veselin there, and she told us about hearing the terrorist. There was a woman sitting next to her with the bomb, but she also had a radio, and she turned the radio on, and the news report came on, and the news said the theater has now been surrounded by Russian special forces. There are snipers positioned everywhere, and they're getting ready to storm the theater. There was panic inside the theater, because everyone in that theater who was Russian knew that there were several cases in the past where the Chechens had taken hostages, the Russians had tried to rescue them, and hundreds of Russians had died. And it's the same thing happened this time, except that it was a little different. The scenario was different. And that gas was, we still don't know what it was.
There's so much to talk about with you. It's quite remarkable, really. And that's what's interesting, too, because, you know, you're obviously a remarkable presence, but you say in that introduction, I think, to 57 Hours, helping other people tell their stories is something I do know how to do as a translator and an editor. So, in a sense, you switch off your own story and tell other people's stories. Why?
I don't know. It's something, I think there's a temperament involved in translating, which you can easily transfer to editing. I noticed that Louise Dennis is here tonight. She's my great mentor when it comes to editing, because when she offered me the job of translating The Engineer of Human Souls, and when I gave her my first draft and she handed it back and it was covered with remarks, my first response was dismay, oh God, I failed. My second response was, these are really interesting comments and I'd better deal with them. And it was over the years of working with Louise that I learned how to deal with this kind of process without involving my own ego. A lot of writers, especially younger writers, are quite tender, and when you start trying to edit them, they get very upset, and some older writers do too. But it's a process that I think that a translator has to step back and just sort of be a mouthpiece for the writer. I mean, so that for 20 years, I was acting as someone else's voice, or at least giving them a voice in English.
But that's a new voice, though, isn't it? Because you've just described how about Rubble,
right.
And you make it more vivid
right.
because you can't do the wordplay necessarily in English.
Right.
You are you're casting a different kind of prism of light on something, and it's coming out in a different kind of colour that you're giving it.
I suppose so. I mean, I think that's inevitable, but it's not to give yourself play, it's to give the work play. And it's the same when you're editing a book, you want the writer's voice to shine through. And there are many ways in which writers and translators obviously shoot themselves in the foot. And the editor's job is to stand in for the reader and say, I think if you fix this, your voice will be that much stronger, and the reader will have a much better time with your piece.
But there's a real self-effacement with this, because if we read any of your literary critiques or, you know, reviews or essays, Paul Wilson has a voice and he has very learned and interesting opinions about things. You're smiling because you're embarrassed about this, but
sort of, yeah.
Yeah, why?
I don't know. It's just the way I am, I guess. it's just a kind of a state of being, you know, when you're doing this. It doesn't mean that your ego isn't involved. It just means that the satisfaction that you get is the satisfaction in making other people look good. And that's the only way that a book will work if you're an editor. It's the only way a translation will work if you're a translator. It's the only way a magazine will work if you're a magazine editor. You have to make other people look good. It's just part of the job, you know.
Paul Wilson, a very interesting and self-effacing man. That conversation, originally broadcast on the Books and Writing program, was recorded at the 2004 Blue Metropolis Literary Festival in Montreal. He was for a time the editor-in-chief of the Canadian magazine The Walrus, and his book 57 Hours, A Survivor's Account of the Moscow Hostage Drama, was co-written by Veselin Nedkov and published by Penguin Canada. You're with The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Ramona Koval. One writer who has a fascination with modern rituals and rites of passage is Wendela Vida. She wrote her first non-fiction book called Girls on the Verge about American women's initiation rituals like sorority rushes, debutante balls, gang inductions. And since then she said she wants to write a trilogy about the dark side of rites of passage, a sort of female version of Catcher in the Rye. She says she, quote, set out to write a trilogy about violence and forgiveness to explore these themes through various angles and plots. The first novel in the trilogy was And Now You Can Go, and her latest, Let the Northern Lights Erase Your Name. In this novel, the central character is searching for her paternity after she discovers that the man who raised her was not her biological father, and the search takes her to Lapland. And our reviewer, Ryan Payne, was dazzled by the Northern Lights.
I saw Wendela Vida read the opening passages of Let the Northern Lights Erase Your Name, and was caught in a reverie as soon as I heard this opening sentence. It was 3 p.m. when my plane landed at the Helsinki airport, but outside my window, dusk was already settling in like a bruise. I was really taken by that setting. Wendela had just introduced the book, about 28-year-old Clarissa Iverton, who would suffer a family trauma before running away to Lapland in search of her true past. And already the bruises had begun to appear. I dwelt on that image until I tuned back in, with no idea what was going on, just hoping that some other Perla would come up and I could continue on a new reverie. I was compelled to buy the book and devoured it in one sitting. Northern Lights opens in Helsinki with Clarissa on her way to Finland in the region of Lapland above the Northern Arctic Circle. She is on her way to find her biological father, after a series of family betrayals have left her as cold and rigid as the Norwegian coastline. The passivity with which Clarissa moves through her story is initially baffling, but suggests a character who has lost faith in love and the goodness of those around her. She seems resigned to the fact that things will only get worse for her by making this journey. Yet she goes, and this resignation proves vital in understanding her behaviour later in the book, as she must face what she learns about her family and herself. The sparsity of Wendela Vida's prose makes it seem like there is not a word out of place. The release of emotional tension feels carefully considered. Yet, when you find out that her mother, stepfather, and fiancé have all been withholding the true identity of her father, the way she ditches them and flees to Lapland seems too rash. You can rationalise her response. Her mother abandoned her when she was 14. She's in shock after the recent death of Richard, the man she loved as a father for 30 years. She feels betrayed by her fiancé, and the name on her birth certificate is Eero Valkapea, the Sami priest her mother had been married to 30 years ago, before she bailed on him too, leaving him in Finland, where he presumably still lives. So she is in search of the idea of her mother as much as her biological father. But you shouldn't have to intellectualise it this much. I've never been sure what to call this, but there is a line that a writer needs to draw between themselves and the reader. It is an amorphous boundary characterised by intuition on both sides. Vandella toes the line more precariously than many other authors. Authors who lack the subtlety required to achieve this balance. In fact, initially, Vandella seems overconfident. When Clarissa leaves behind what's left of her family and goes to Lapland, there is too little backstory, or even much in the way of present-day interior monologue, to explain why she feels so aggrieved by the news, why she would so readily cut the ties with the two men who she has loved most dearly since the departure of her mother. Of course, the reader tries to empathize with her, but this is what I mean when I talk about the intuitive boundary line between writer and reader. At this crucial point, where the reader must be able to engage with the character in order to care about her story, Vandella doesn't give the reader enough to go on. She eventually does introduce Clarissa's backstory into the narrative, and you do begin to understand more about her nature. But I am worried that Vandella's stylistic restraint could be a significant barrier to the broad appeal of this book. I would still urge all readers to push on, because Northern Lights well and truly redeems itself. Paradoxically, it does so by developing the plot and emotional development of Clarissa with the same sparsity that frustrated me in the beginning. I won't give a plot summary, except to say that a number of convenient plot developments made me feel that Vandella would wrap the loose ends up too neatly. After developing a character with a lifetime of experiences working against her luck, it could only have been implausible to have Clarissa act out the most simple, predictable, and happy resolution to her lifelong problems. Instead, as Clarissa begins to understand the way her mother behaved over the past 30 years, so the reader begins to understand the way Clarissa is behaving now. She has been robbed of the ability to love and to be loved. Her previous passivity and coldness begin to make sense, as it is difficult to imagine a sorrow greater than that felt by someone who cannot bear to love. As Vandella foreshadows how Clarissa will take this affliction into the rest of her life, she never attempts to convince the reader that Clarissa will ever be miraculously healed and live happily ever after. She never demands an implausible meeting of hers and the reader's understanding of the limitations of human nature. Let the Northern Lights Erase Your Name manages to define that elusive, intuitive line between writer and reader, both of whom understand that Clarissa may not overcome her emotional trauma in her whole lifetime, let alone within the time frame of the book. This understanding of human nature makes me feel that if you are going to learn anything about real life through fiction, Vandella Vida's books would be a great place to start.
Ryan Payne reviewing Vandella Vida's latest novel, Let the Northern Lights Erase Your Name. It's published by Penguin. Over the last 2 weeks in first person, we've been on a voyage with Jenny Diske, as described in her book Skating to Antarctica. On the one hand, we've journeyed with her onboard ship, admiring icebergs and the startling white landscape. On the other, we've travelled back with her through her memories of a difficult childhood, in which the figure of her mother loomed large. As a result, Jenny cut off all contact with her mother back in 1966, but now, 30 years on, her daughter Chloe wants to know about the grandmother she's never met. This has been the catalyst for Jenny's emotional journey back through those memories, hitherto kept suppressed. The reader is Julia Blake.
The will to live was not strong in my family. I had my own version of it, which I had developed into a passion for oblivion. It began in earnest at 14, when I discovered that sniffing ether stolen from the chemistry laboratory at school put me out for what seemed like several lifetimes, although I was assured when I came round that I'd only been unconscious for a couple of minutes. This elongation of existential emptiness was a delight to me. The ether was one of the reasons I was expelled. When I took my mother's Nembutal in her room in Hove, it was because I wanted everything to stop. I had no definite thought about killing myself, only of stopping everything. Same result, but different feeling. Later, after I left school in the late 60s and started taking whatever drugs were around, What gave me most pleasure was to inject dissolved Nembutal directly into my veins. This had the effect of rendering me instantly and utterly unconscious. Only years later did it occur to me that this was a very bizarre way to have fun, but it wasn't really fun I was after. It was nothingness. Between my mother's Nembutal and my own, I spent some time in the psychiatric hospitals being treated for depression. But what they were for me were places of safety, blank places of white sheets and nothing happening. I didn't have to do anything about day-to-day living. Even Sister Winnicky was preferable to getting on with living. I did not want to function, to live my own life, to achieve anything. I only wanted to be let alone. Being depressed is very painful, but it is also silence and absence. There is a paradox. The pain, real anguish, is intolerable. I would do almost anything not to experience it. But the silence and absence of the place where depression puts you brings the possibility of getting close to contentment. This is not to say that I had any conscious control over depression, only that I discovered that sometimes, if I sat through the pain, I got to a place of absolute peace and quiet. This is not a statement of the value of depression. Depression is rotten. You cannot sit through the pain if your circumstances aren't right, if you haven't got support, or if you have people depending on you. And even if those conditions can somehow be met, to sit through the pain carries the very real risk that you will not survive it. But given that depression happened to me and I did have support, I found it was possible, after a time, to achieve a kind of joy totally disconnected from the world. I wanted to be unavailable and in that place without the pain. I still want it. It is coloured white and filled with a singing silence. It is an endless ice rink. It is Antarctic. The week before I returned from Antarctica, Chloe had gone off for a fortnight to South Africa with her dad. The house was empty when I got home. I like the silence of an empty flat after I've been away, gives a chance to repossess the place. On top of the piles of post on the kitchen table was a note from Chloe saying she'd opened anything interesting looking, and it turned out nothing was. On my desk in the study was a small pile of papers, topped by another note from Chloe. About your mum and dad, I went to Hove with Dad to your mum's house. Hove was where my mother had last lived, where I'd last lived with her for just 2 days after I'd run away from my father and Pam in Banbury. Chloe had been busy while I was away. On top of the pile were some certificates. The first was my father's birth certificate. Beneath this was a death certificate announcing the death of James Simmons, 57 years, a sales representative in Banbury. He died of myocardial infarction and ventricular fibrillation on the 20th of April 1966. A year before he died, he took me out to lunch and handed me an envelope which was not to be opened until he'd gone back to Banbury. I went to the loo and read the letter. It was a suicide note. By the time you read this, enclosing the logbook for his car, which I would receive as soon as his estate was sorted out, and details of his life insurance policy, the proceeds of which were to come to me on Pam's demise. He simply informed me of his forthcoming suicide, giving no reasons beyond not being able to stand it any more. The main point of the letter was to get straight what I would and wouldn't inherit. I returned to the table, frozen, said nothing, barely breathed until he left, and then went to Jelly. I had just let him go, not mention the letter, pretended I hadn't read it. I hadn't even tried to stop him. I was put to bed, a weeping heap. When I called his number the following day, he answered the phone, sounded jovial, never mentioned the letter. Neither did I. I cut off contact with him. Then he died of a heart attack. There was another certificate in the sheaf of papers left for me by Chloe. It stated that Rachel Simmons, otherwise Renee Simmons, maiden name unknown, had died on the 28th of March, 1988, at the Royal Sussex Hospital, Brighton. The last address of the deceased was 3 Third Avenue, Hove. My mother was dead. But what struck me most forcefully, as I put the certificate on top of the pile, was the thought that she'd been alive for 20 years, after the time I'd last seen her. The death certificate confirmed, most immediately and most shockingly, not her death, but her existence up to 1988. It wasn't that I had been certain that she was dead, only that, in uncertainty, she stopped existing for me. But she hadn't stopped existing. She'd been around all along, living, breathing, thinking. And instantly the past looked darker and more cluttered than I had pictured it up to then. There had been the possibility all along, up to 1988, the retrospective possibility that she might have made contact, might, as in my worst early hours anxiety, have turned up in my life. She hadn't. She might have. Only for the last 8 years had she truly not existed. Only since 1988 had I been really orphaned, truly safe. Finding her last address on the death certificate, Chloe had gone off sleuthing to Hove. The bottom pages in the pile were her description, typed up for me, of what she'd found out. 3 Third Avenue, Hove. Flat 3, Thomas someone, the caretaker. Flat 4, Renee Simmons. Flat 6, John T. Flat 8, Bill E. Flat 11, Weirdo Washer Upper. This intro had the pleasing distance of a play. Pinter, perhaps. It continued. The road is wide. When we went there, everything looked grey, but a light bright grey, with blue sea at the end. I was surprised by its location. Look out of the front window to your right, about 200 metres, and you see the sea. Renee's flat didn't face that way. The intimacy of that Renee was startling. I used to wonder from time to time what I would call her if she did turn up again. Mummy was out of the question. Renee wouldn't have done either. It might have indicated that I was ready to take her on to look after her. Perhaps, I'd concluded, I'd call her Mrs. Simmons. But Chloe seemed to have made some relationship with her during her search, though I was happy to see it wasn't close enough to call her Granny. The door was left open. We tried all the bells from the bottom. There were 11 or 12, and none of them answered until we got to 6. John T. didn't act amazingly surprised by our mention of the name and was happy to have us talk to him and ask whether we'd like to come up or him down. We went up. Can't remember the smell. I guess not that striking, possibly musty. There are 2 bedsits on each level. Flat 6 was on the far side of the building, and John opened the door as we arrived. But although he knew Renee, they weren't close. She was very withdrawn, he said. Renee lived in her old bedsit, the one you knew, with a man called Jack. She never mentioned you or your father to John T. We'd stayed about 10 minutes, and most of the time he was saying, I wish I could tell you more, but I don't know anything else about her, or words to that effect. I imagine Jack was the man who was with my mother once when she'd visited me in the hospital. She lived with him then. Well, I was glad she wasn't alone. Did I mind that she never mentioned me to John T? I noticed it. So perhaps she put all that, me and my father, her bad luck, behind her. Perhaps she had made a real life for herself with Jack. We didn't know whether to go to Flat 8's door or ring the bell. We decided just to knock. Said your mother and Jack were always at each other's throats. The house shook with their fights. Ah, No change, after all. This Renée began to come more clearly into view as the woman I once knew. My mother and Jack, always at each other's throats in the house of the not quite right, making the best and the worst of things. But after Jack died, she lost the will to live. Nothing to live for, isolated. I guess she had no one and didn't want anything to do with anyone. Bill said he once had a conversation with her about her ex-husband, and she fondly recalled a romance in Paris. That's all. He mentioned that the caretaker in flat 3 might have some more information, as he cleared the flat after she died. There was no answer at his flat, but we left a note with your number explaining what we wanted. He hasn't rung back. There it was. My mother, firmly dead, the unknown remains of her life lived in a gloomy house in Hove, fighting with a man and remembering Paris. Nothing really had changed. Chloe called from South Africa the next day. Are you upset?
No.
Yes. Disturbed. Not surprised. But at least she didn't turn out to be some sweet old lady who everyone loved. I was worried she might. It was a bit of a relief to hear she went on being the way you told me she was. Me too. Chloe was right, that it was a relief to know that my version of my mother had been corroborated. It was terrible in a way that I should be so relieved to find that she had remained just as I had remembered her, that she had been as I had remembered her. Not fair on her as ever. But as I began to read Chloe's notes, I had a sharp moment of anxiety that everything I recalled, everything I had told my daughter, might have been imagined, fantasized, fictioned. I preferred my mother's continued unhappiness to finding myself to have been deluded all these years. "Sad about her losing the will to live, though," Chloe said. Yes, but what Bill E. didn't know was that my mother lost the will to live 3 times a week. It was a habit with her. Will you go to Hove?
No.
Will you write to the caretaker?
No.
But you're pleased I went?
Very. Very pleased, thank you.
That's okay. Good to know about your mother at last, eh?
Yes, I think it is.
And that was the final episode of Skating to Antarctica by Jenny Diskey, read for us by Julia Blake. It was abridged for radio by Christine Kinsella. The sound engineer was Paul Penton, and it was produced in our Melbourne studios by Justine Sloan-Lees. Skating to Antarctica is published by Virago, and if you're interested in Jenny Diskey's other books, you could check out her website, which is jennydiskey.co.uk. That's jennydiski.co.uk. Next week in First Person, a book show favourite, Christopher Kremer, with The Carpet Wars. Thanks this week go to the producers of the book show, Liz Gray, Michael Sheriffs, Sarah Lestrange, Kate Piercy, and technical producer Paul Penton. On the Sunday book show after the 7 p.m. news, you can hear my conversation with Irish poet Paul Muldoon, plus a meditation on writing, silence and solitude. And on Monday's book show, another treat from the archives, a conversation with a wonderful writer, the 84-year-old Brooklyn novelist and memoirist, Paula Fox. That's on Monday's book show after the 10 a.m. news. Remember, you can hear this program again by going to our website, abc.net.au/rn/bookshow, where you can download us as a podcast, and you can find today's guest and book details there too. That's all from me, Ramona Koval, on ABC Radio National. Time now for the news.